Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
The following is a recording made by Sir Charles Moses in his office at the Asian Broadcasting Union in Sydney on Monday, the 25th of January, 1971.
Hello, I'm Jane Connors with a birthday edition of Verbatim, marking the 70th anniversary of the founding of the ABC on July 1, 1932. At the time it all began, the ABC was little more than a collection of 12 radio stations and several hundred employees who were dotted around the country. It was only available to those listeners who'd paid a licence fee. Everything was live in those days, with more than half the programs being music and the rest of the time taken up by radio drama, sport and educative talks. Pope Pius XI and Adolf Hitler both spoke on air in the first year of operation. But our speaker today comes right from the heart of the corporation's history. Sir Charles Moses was the general manager of the ABC for 30 years, from 1935 to retirement in 1965, by which time, of course, we'd taken television on board. Charles Moses migrated to Australia from England in 1922, after 4 years in the army. He grew fruit and veggies near Bendigo, but was ruined during a year of glut, and turned to selling cars through rural Victoria and the Riverina. But this also dried up as times grew tough at the end of the 20s.
And I was looking for something else, and something I wanted to do was to get into broadcasting. Well, I was went along to each broadcasting organisation in Melbourne. I remember having a letter from 3UZ in which they said they would get in touch with me. However, finally I went along to see the Australian Broadcasting Company, and this was my last chance, and I very nearly slipped altogether. I made an inquiry, and I was told, yes, if I wanted to see the manager, if I'd wait a few minutes. And then a young man came out, a bright young fellow with a black moustache, whose name was Walker, and said to me, "What do you want?" I said, "Oh, I want to see the manager." He said, "What about?" I said, "About announcing." He said, "You're wasting your time." I said, "I'm sorry." And I turned to walk out of the door, and I would have walked out of broadcasting at that moment. But the girl on the switchboard, Miss Leonard, said to me, "Look, if you want to see the manager, why don't you wait?" Well, I waited another quarter of an hour or so, and I went in to see the manager, Mr. Bearup. I had a talk with him, and he arranged for me to have a test. And I had my own ideas. I felt that some of the announcing was rather stilted, stereotyped, and I thought I'd introduce something new into my test. I thought I did well, and I was told that I should get in touch with the manager, and he might have something for me in a week or so. Well, I got in touch with him regularly for the next couple of months, every week, and I really I was very despondent about ever getting anything, when one day when I rang him up, his reply was, "Do you know anything about ice hockey?" I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "Are you sure?" I said, "Yes, I've played it." As a matter of fact, I had played hockey on ice with stones for goalposts, 11 a side, just the same as soccer, just the same as field hockey. Anyway, he said, "Come up to see me." And I went up. So it was arranged that I would be down at the Glacierium at 7:30 and would come on the air at about 8:05. I went to Robertson and Mullins, the local bookshop, to get a book on ice hockey, and I was horrified to find I knew nothing about it. They didn't play with a ball, but with a puck. Not 11 aside, but some 6 aside. There was no offside. It was a most extraordinary game, but anyway, I spent my afternoon learning the rules of the game, and I was there with me as a technician was a man called Reg Fox. Well, before 7:45, he was trying to raise the studios. 7:55, when I was due on the air, there was still no contact. 8:00, and I thought to myself, well, anyway, they'll have to give me another chance. And I was so relieved to think I didn't have to go through it that night. Just before 8:30, suddenly there was a sound on the bell, and Reg Fox said to me, "You're on the air." And in the middle of the game, I then had to go on with my description. Of course, I had no option. I just had to do it because this was my one opportunity. I was married. I had two children. I would have been out of a job. This was the one chance I had. And it went well. I went back to the studio, and the head of programs, one Mr. W.G. James, who was later the ABC's director of music, Mr. James said he thought it had gone very well, and in fact offered to drive me back to most of the way home to Camberwell Junction. Well, this, I thought, was a very promising start. In any case, the manager did put me on the next week. I started at 3 o'clock on this Monday afternoon, and there was a comedian, a stage comedian named Perrin, acting as the announcer for the day, and he gave me my first bit of tuition. And then he said, well, now you have a go. And I said, well, I will if you'll go into the control room, because I was very nervous. Anyway, I started off myself. That was the only introduction I had to studio broadcasting, apart from the test that I'd given some weeks before. And I was then a member of the staff on 3AR with my colleague, who was Cliff Bradshaw. We shared the day sessions and the night sessions on 3AR. We actually started in the morning on 3LO because the gentlemen of 3LO, Morris Dudley and his colleague, Hatherley, they didn't believe in getting up so early, and we, rather lesser announcers, had to do the early morning shift. ...3AR had one studio. It was a studio some 35 to 40 feet long, about 15 feet wide, and about 10 feet high. And when you had, as we often did, every week we had a band of some 30 players and singers, and sometimes a small choir, in that stuffy place, it was just like the black hole of Calcutta. The air really was impossible. And it used to get so bad that in my time there, in a little over 2 years, twice I went through the floor. There was dry rot in the floor of the studio. It was just, the conditions were so bad. No staff association would allow it to happen. But I know that you came into that studio, if you'd been outside, and the fog, it was so thick, you really felt it was completely stifling. It's surprising that people were able to sing or play at all. But you want to remember, that was the Depression, and everybody was very anxious to get an extra pound or two.
This is Verbatim on Radio National, where ABC Managing Director Charles Moses is describing his early years with Auntie. Being anxious for a pound or two himself, the young sports commentator was happy to take a promotion in January 1933, when asked to move to Sydney and take on the job of sports editor.
My duties were to... I was in charge of all sport. I was expected to broadcast as many sports as I could. And after I'd been in Sydney for a week, I was given the extra responsibility of being put in charge of talks. And some 3 months later, I was sent down to negotiate with the Education Department of New South Wales about starting school broadcasts. And this wasn't straightforward because there was quite a strong feeling among the teachers that broadcasting could be prejudicial to their livelihood. Broadcasting perhaps might even replace the teacher. So one had to go very slowly in this, but I was also able to set up a talks advisory committee and try to get away from what had been done for some time, which was to have some half-hour talks, which were supposed to be for people who were studying some particular subject, but they were most boring. The speakers were almost invariably very poor, and it was quite obvious that they would attract no audience at all. So we tried to brighten up the talks. We got more interesting material, and I found myself before the end of 1933 not only as sporting editor but as the officer in charge of school broadcasts and of talks generally. Also, I was in charge of news, I was the chairman of the children's session, and I was in charge of the women's session, having with me as assistant Gladys Owen, or Mrs. John Moore, as she was. And so I found my time very fully occupied. My week went like this. On a Monday, I was out at Leichhardt, taking notes on the wrestling and boxing matches of the evening, and this would be from 8 o'clock to about 10:30, and at 11 o'clock, giving a resume in the studio. Tuesday, I went training for Eastern Suburbs Rugby Union team, trained between 8 and 10. I normally got home somewhere about 11. Thursday, I trained again, the second night training. Friday, I was able to go home, so it's twice a week I got home, and on Saturday, I was at the main stadium. So I was busy four nights a week, and in 1934, when the Australian test team was visiting the UK, I was expected to, and did give, a resume of the state of the cricket match at lunchtime in every game. County match and every other sort of match. So I was in the studio at 11 o'clock every night, excepting Sunday night. And also, by the way, I had my sporting session at 6:30 to 6:45 every night. So my home life was practically nil during that summer. It was a very difficult summer for me. I was in the office every day at 9 o'clock and going about my normal duties, and then, as I said, doing all the other things in the evening. Early in 1934, it was about 14 or 15 months after I'd come to Sydney, I had a call to go to the university to see the Vice-Chancellor, Sir Robert Wallace, who was a member of the Commission. The Vice-Chancellor asked me if I would be interested in becoming controller of talks. He said to me, "You understand, of course, that this will mean that you have to give up your sporting broadcasts." Well, I enjoyed my sporting broadcasts, but I also realized that here I was being given an opportunity to do something in a much more important field. And I said, yes, I said I would. I might say, although I was invited at the beginning of 1934, and I was told that I would never do any more sporting broadcasts, in fact, the general manager persuaded the commission to let me go ahead and do the test cricket. He felt it was so important, and I think the commission agreed that it was so important that we should do the 1934 series in England. So although I was appointed, I think in March or April of 34, I didn't in fact move to head office and take up my job until October, after the last test in England. And so from around about the beginning of October 1934, I then became the, as I said, the first federal officer other than the general manager and the accountant secretary. Amongst the series we have, I remember one particularly well, and this was one of the first that we did on National Relay. It was imaginary discussions, and I remember one being done between Hitler and Napoleon. And the part of Hitler was taken by H.D. Black, Herman Black. He is now, as you know, the Chancellor of the University of Sydney. And he did it extremely well. He managed to put on an excellent half-German type of accent. But it was a very frank discussion in which Napoleon was very critical of the Hitler of 1934. At that time, by the way, used to produce the booklets as well, the early booklets of the ABC, both national talks and the educational, the school broadcasts. You'll see if you look at them that they've got my initials in the corner of the cover. I devised the cover and used to edit the material inside and deal with the printer and get them all issued. Of course, in those days, There was no charge for the booklets. The ABC provided the booklets for the schools. The ABC provided booklets to listeners who wanted to listen to the important talks that were broadcast nationally.
In 1935, Moses was asked by the ABC chairman, in a casual sort of way, what he thought he'd do if he was ever offered the top job. He ran up a 12-page document, spoke to some board members, and 2 months later, at the age of 35, was appointed managing director.
When I took over as general manager of the ABC, I think my total staff would have been 389, and our annual expenditure was somewhere in the vicinity of £350,000. That, of course, sounds very small beer when you compare it with a staff of round about 5,000 when I left and an expenditure of round about £14 million, $28 million as it would be nowadays. In those days, broadcasting, of course, hadn't reached the stage where it is now, that of with every home having a radio set. I would think that somewhere between 20-25% of homes might have had radios, and whilst the ABC was recognised as being the organisation which provided major sporting events, whether it was football from rugby league or rugby union football or test cricket, the ABC was looked on as being the organisation which would provide this. It also was the only organisation which covered major events, major national events, whether it was the Victorian centenary or the New South Wales sesquicentenary, or it may have been the arrival of the Duke of Gloucester, this sort of thing. The ABC was normally the organisation that tackled it and gave it to the people. In the years before the war, particularly, of course, after the Test cricket season of 1934, when there was a big increase in the number of radio sets, the radio licences, there was a steady increase right up to the time of the war, but not a spectacular increase. And with the increase in the number of licences, then, of course, there was a growth in the importance of the ABC in the community, in that there were more people exposed to what was coming to them through their wireless sets. When I took over, I think there were quite a number of people that doubted whether the National Broadcasting Service would be able to continue, at least in the years immediately after the war. There was a very great doubt about this. But for myself, as a young man in 1935, I had no doubt. I was convinced that the ABC would be able to prove more and more valuable to the community and would fully justify itself as an important national organisation. I never had any doubt in my own mind about that. It was the broadcasting of such things as school broadcasts, and the news services of those days, even though they were not extensive as they are today, at least they had the great advantage over others in that they were completely impartial. The people who prepared the news services had no axe to grind. They were not pushing somebody's barrow at all. And so that the listeners did feel that from the ABC they were getting an objective news service. It may not have been as extensive as some people would have liked, but that was merely the fault of... We can't say it's a fault. There's merely because of the fact that we got our news from the sources that the newspapers did, and we were only allowed to use a limited amount of the material that was available to us. We didn't have staff of journalists or news collectors or agents all over the country who would supply news items, so that our news service was not extensive, but at least it did have that value to the public of being objective and fair. And we made up for this, of course, by having regular news commentaries. News commentaries used to follow the midday bulletins around about 1 o'clock, and news commentaries were also given in evenings, and particularly there was a weekly commentary given by a man called The Watchman. That was his pseudonym. He had a tremendous influence on people, and as far as myself and the commission were concerned, we felt that perhaps sometimes it was too great an influence, in that one man perhaps had too great an influence from his point of view.
Miss Batten, on behalf of the Mascot Council and the citizens of Mascot, I welcome you to Mascot and congratulate you on that wonderful record-breaking flight from England to Australia.
Ladies and gentlemen, I do want to say how very pleased I am to have arrived here safely, and I do also want to thank you for waiting here for my arrival. I've just been told that some people have been here since early this morning, and I'm only sorry that I could not have arrived sooner, but after all, it is a woman's privilege to be a little late.
At the beginning of broadcasting, because the people who had charge of the programs in the early days were people with a background of theatre, it was always looked on that your evening program as such started round about 8 o'clock. During the day, it was records mostly, interspersed with a few talks, an odd bulletin or two of news, some news commentaries, but mostly records right through. Around about 7:30, between 7 and 8 o'clock, there may be occasionally a string quartet playing, but the evening entertainment always started at 8 o'clock and went on till 10:30 or 11, just like the theatre. And in fact, the programme itself was something like the old variety theatre. It depended on the night of the week, but each week there would be a night with a brass band. That meant the brass band came in at 8:30 and would be playing round until somewhere towards 11 o'clock, and it would play either perhaps a long suite or a group of marches or some other short items, and in between these groups, these sections of their program, there would be somebody would sing, as we used to say, a bracket of three songs, or somebody would play a couple of piano solos. A comedian would come on. On still other nights, there would be a light orchestra. And then there would be the night when there was a play, and perhaps one other night, a musical comedy. Sunday night, there was always a play. After that, we had our what was called meditation music. Now, this was the format that had been established before I took over in 1935, and in fact continued at least for 18 months afterwards. But then we made a change in that we looked on the evening's program as being a number of segments. And it was in 1936, for example, 36-37, that we established a half-hour program of dance music, of high-class dance music. And then we had a short play. We had a short documentary. It was during 1936 that this important change was made in the national programs, to change them from being an evening's entertainment at a theatre or an imitation of that sort of thing, and we began to provide radio programs.
Charles Moses continued to work as the ABC's managing director for the following 30 years, minus several years of active service during the Second World War. He retired in 1965, and you've been listening to his memories from his early days with Auntie here on Verbatim. Our thanks today to Jim Davidson and the ABC Dance Band, to John Spence from the ABC's Radio Archives, and to David Bates for technical production. I'm Jane Connors, and Australia's oral history will roll out again on Verbatim next week, and we'll see you then.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.